Hi, I'm Shane Hurlbut. I'm an ASC cinematographer, and I wanted to kind of talk to you about something. Getting started in this industry is almost impossible. And my wife Lydia and I, 14 years ago, created a resource called Filmmakers Academy to make it possible. We saw a lot of gatekeeping in this industry and not a lot of sharing knowledge. So we wanted to pull back the curtain, give you confidence, teach you all the necessary skills to be an amazing, successful filmmaker, and package it all on this online resource that you have at your fingertips, on set, on your phone, on your laptop, whatever it is. So we're going to give you $50. So if you go into the show notes, click the link, and hit the promo code FAPOD50, you're going to get $50 on your first year of an all-access membership. And I cannot wait for you to join our immense and immersive community at Filmmakers Academy, where we network, we share knowledge, we just bond as this huge filmmaking resource to ignite your creativity and push you beyond your boundaries. I cannot wait to see you in the Academy, and let's get to the podcast.
Welcome to this episode of the Inner Circle Podcast. I'm Lydia Hurlbut, your host, and I am joined today by Brendan Sweeney, our FA team member. Welcome, Brendan.
How's it going?
And we are so lucky to have in studio today Rudy Mancuso, the director of Musica, and Shane Hurlbut, ASC cinematographer on that film. It is out on Prime Video and just had the world premiere at South by Southwest. And so Brendan and I are going to talk all things Musica. So let's get into it. Welcome. We're so excited to have you, Rudy.
We're so excited to be here.
Isn't Absolutely.
What an awesome introduction.
Yeah, and Shane. I love you. So, Rudy, this film is absolutely extraordinary. And I think unlike anything any of us have ever experienced, because it's a little bit, it's a love story, it's a musical. Mm-hmm. The music is such a part of, it's the soul of the film, and I know how much you put into that as a musician. And so I think what really touched me the most, other than the love story, was really the theme of being true to yourself and not constantly trying to meet the needs of others to find happiness and joy.
Yeah. I mean, it's very authentic to my own experience. And the theme sort of found itself as we were making it. Reliving a lot of those experiences was interesting, a bit transformative, I would say. But the themes that weren't highlighted early on became highlighted after shooting. Mm-hmm. We were all learning as we were going, because I think we were attempting to do a lot of things that none of us had ever done. Certainly me. And I don't know, I don't want to speak for Shane, but we all tried things that we had no business trying.
And I think something that was so great with Musica, and this is where we really want to pick your background. I actually grew up in New Jersey as well. And I feel like
Where?
I grew up in Belvedere, New Jersey,
okay,
which was kind of closer to the Poconos. So right along.
Yeah, Jersey's big.
Yeah, it is big. A lot of people think it's small, but it's not that small. Mm-hmm. But a big part of this film and what I thought was so beautiful is it really captures, and Shane and you both did such an amazing job, the camaraderie of New Jersey, especially that part of New Jersey where you lived in. Mm-hmm. What was it like? Just talk to us about your background, even before this film was just a concept, what that part of your life was like and how it really just influenced you as an artist.
Yeah, I mean, as you'll see in the film, I grew up primarily with my mother, my Brazilian mother, and it was a small town called Glen Ridge in New Jersey, and the neighboring town was Newark. But specifically where we'd spend most of our time was this little pocket, tight-knit neighborhood known as the Ironbound, which still exists today. And when I was growing up, now it's changed a bit, but when I was growing up, it was almost entirely Brazilian, Portuguese, Hispanic, and the main language spoken was Brazilian Portuguese. So it wow. almost felt like mm-hmm. you're in a mini Brazil. I mean, to speak English within that like few mile radius mm-hmm. was very strange. You didn't hear English. If you spoke English, you got strange looks. And everything in the film was authentic to my experience. I would go mm-hmm. to that fish market, and we had the luxury of shooting at the actual fish market that I would go to.
Yeah, that's awesome.
We had the luxury of shooting at the actual restaurant that I would frequent, the actual city streets, and we even got to shoot in my actual mother's home where I grew up.
Yeah, that was a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, Shane somehow made the most of a very limited space,
mm-hmm. yeah.
but it was worth it because I can look back at it and say I shot in my actual childhood home. Not a lot of filmmakers and actors get to say that.
And and I think that the roles that you took on, and we're going to dive into so many topics. So for those, you know, do not leave this episode because Rudy, okay, you directed, you acted, you composed, you sang, you had a puppet,
you wrote,
thank you. All there's so many roles that you're playing, and mm-hmm. it's based on your life story or a version of your life.
Did you give yourself credit for puppeteering?
There's the one credit I forgot. I signed up to wear all these hats, not because I felt I was the only one who could, but it was the only way to make sure that the experience was as authentic as it could possibly be. Mm-hmm. And it's not like all these different departments are far removed from each other. To me, it's one big umbrella. With a story like this, directing was composing. Composing was writing, and writing was acting. They were all so heavily intertwined, more mm-hmm. than ever. It wasn't like we defer to a music department to handle all the music. No, the music is quite literally happening in the middle of the dialogue, in the middle of the scene. Because they're so heavily intertwined, I didn't feel like I was wearing multiple hats. It was all just one big hat. But we would joke a lot of times on set where it's like, this movie doesn't have a director. Because I was in every single scene as the actor. And it was certainly challenging, but I think for this story, necessary.
Right.
I agree. And I think I have two parents that are musicians. I think let's start with the music and then, Brendan, please dive in.
Yeah,
it's my cinephile here.
Yeah. I think a good place for us to start, too, is I really want to paint the picture of what Musica is. That way people know what Musica, thank you. Musica is. Yeah. So people understand the project.
Sure.
If you could give our best, give your best elevator pitch, and then we'll go into some of the technical details. I would really love to hear that.
Cool. Happy to. Musica is a story loosely based on my life and experience about a young guy trying to come to terms with the reality of his life, trying to juggle family, culture, relationships, all through this synesthetic perspective. The character and myself have a condition called synesthesia. There are various different types of synesthesia, and this one is a very music-oriented form of iteration of the condition, and the film is all told through that lens. So it's a love story as much as it is a coming of age, and the twist is this strange musical perspective that I had never really seen before, and that's why we got so excited.
And when did you start having the ideas for this project? And I know that you and Shane both met on Rim of the World. That's kind of what I surmised, right?
Yeah.
During that period when you both started working together, I know you were acting, Shane was shooting the movie. Was this project in mind? Were you working towards this? I know that you wrote the short film before actually producing the feature, but when did you start to say, man, I really want to put this on the big screen?
This story has been on my mind for as long as I could remember. I want to say over a decade. Mm-hmm. Before I even started making stories and content on the internet, I knew I wanted to one day make a film through this bizarre musical perspective. And I knew I wanted to be loosely based on my own life because as Brazilian-American, Brazilian culture and the Portuguese language, in my opinion, are very underrepresented. So this is an opportunity to do both. Mm-hmm. It really took a wizard and scientist like Shane to pull some of this stuff off because I felt it was exciting to him. Because visually, there was an opportunity to really dream up all kinds of bizarre pieces. And sonically, there was an opportunity to do so much musically. The fun part was figuring out how those two
work together.
Yeah. I remember the first time Shane showed me the short film that you did for Musica. And I've known Shane for, I don't know what, like 8 years now. And he's done so many projects through that. But what was one of the like greatest moments was Shane was like, look at this project, Rudy Mancuso. I was like, oh, well, yeah, I know him from all of your previous work. And he was like, just look at the creativity in this short that he really wants to bring to life, and he's considering me to shoot it. And I really want to speak to that moment, mm-hmm. Shane, because I did think it was quite unique in where your mind was at before you guys were really even in the talks to doing it together. What was the first thing that you thought of with Musica?
So this has only happened Musica. Two times in my whole career, okay, where I, on Drumline, I got sent a script. And the producer called me up and said, and I happened to be in Kansas City. I was a director cameraman on a children's hospital spot. And he goes, have you read the script? And I go, Tim, I'm directing this spot. I don't know if I'm into this Saints Go Marching In bullshit, you know? I just like the people drumming and going in and tubas flying. He goes, where are you? I'm like, Jesus, I'm at a Marriott, and what's the address? And, you know, so I give him all the address, and he goes, we'll talk tomorrow. And I literally walked in coming back from that day of shooting, and there was one of those AV roller carts, because this is back in 2002, right? 2003, where they rolled in the TV with the little VHS deck. And there was a tape there, and it said, play me.
What?
Exactly. So I was like, what the hell is this? So I put it in, and it is a drum line doing a drum battle. And I was running for the frickin' phone. Mm. And I had that same aha moment when, you know, Stephen Bello goes, Shane, I got this kind of quirky little movie. I don't know if you're going to be up for it, but I'd love to see what you think. You know, it's not going to be the biggest budget thing, but I think there's something there. He sent me that sizzle. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I couldn't get to the phone quick enough. I was like, this is so out of the box and so unique. And then when you and I started to do those processes where we did those 3 hour blocks, we did seven in a row. Yeah, remember? We would wake up in the morning, mm-hmm. and you were in New Jersey and I was in LA, mm-hmm. and we just sit there for 3 hours of block, and we would do it via Zoom, and we would literally be saying, okay, oh, let's just mount the, you know, bed to the wall. And we'll, you know, it's like we were, and I'm like drawing little storyboard pictures, and then I'm like putting myself up against the wall, and we're conceptualizing all the shots. And then once we had that baked, oh my God, it was so good, because we had planned the whole movie out from beginning to end. And yeah, that's very few times that I ever get that from a director.
Mm-hmm. So this level of energy and enthusiasm was and is very contagious. I mean, when we officially met for the first time in regard to this project, I was so blown away by his enthusiasm just based off the pages and the sizzle. And I figured if I could get everyone on this project to be as excited to be a part of it as this guy, mm-hmm. Then we'll create something, an environment that's really special and infectious. I obviously knew about Shane's work, and I was a massive fan of a lot of the things that he did. And he, you know, he was a person who shoots big movies. Mm-hmm. And this film, by no means, I wouldn't consider it, although I feel at times it could feel big, it's not a big film. We don't have a huge budget. We don't have a ton of time. We're shooting during COVID. There were so many obstacles and parameters that we had to navigate. And the level of prep that you guide me through, because I had never done this before, not on this scale. I mean, usually it's I have an idea on Monday, I shoot it on Tuesday, it's out on Wednesday. and now we're talking about schematics. I don't even know what schematics means. And I think we're only able to pull off a lot of these set pieces and scenes mm-hmm. and sequences because of that level of prep.
I was just going to say, and I was able to witness the laughter, the creative, because I'm hearing this coming, you know, emanating.
Her office is right behind, you know, we're in dormers in our bedroom. We have two offices in there. So
I would over here.
Yeah, the whole time.
I would hear, this.
And then my son comes in, and at the end of one call, you go, Shane, we're going to change the world. And then Miles heard that when he walked in to talk to Lydia. And then he would say that all the time.
I said that?
Yeah.
Oh, man, I hate me.
But it was so special. And I think that people have to understand, and we're going to dive into this, the depth of this movie from a musical standpoint, from a cinematography standpoint, mm-hmm. from all the layers. But I think that the prep, as you said, and I think that we really need to hit this point because it really matters, mm-hmm. is foundational given the fact that you were doing live music, that the amount of shooting time was really cut down. Mm-hmm. And because it was being recorded live.
And we had all the background rhythm performers that we had to get all dressed, and then we had to then get them to lunch, and then back from lunch, and then back dressed again, and in the...
Oh, yeah, it was a nightmare.
It's like, we had 5.5 hours to shoot,
yeah,
basically, every day.
And I think it would be interesting to hear how you obviously had an original approach with the short film of Musica, and now you're trying to bridge the gap and make this into a feature film. Let's talk about where your headspace was starting, even before Shane came in. What was the inspiration? And then once Shane came in, how did that ultimately change? Did you still find yourself making a similar product, or ultimately with Shane's influence, I assume that it got better, which I know it did, but what were the variables, at least as you as the director?
Well, the vision never changed. Mm. What Shane helped me do was just elevate everything and reimagine a lot of pieces to fit in a more cinematic world. Mm-hmm. All of my material beforehand was very DIY and very makeshift, and it's part of, I think, the charm of a lot of content on the internet.
Absolutely.
Yeah. From a lot of creators is the fact that they're so limited in their resources, and that's something that I'm so glad I had the experience of doing. I mean, there was a time when I was making videos that were 6 seconds long and had to be shot on a phone. You couldn't edit them. You couldn't add music. You couldn't do anything. It was all done in real mm-hmm. time in this 6-second looping video app. If the take wasn't good, you had to start again from scratch. So it was a great education. So imagine I come up with this one sequence in my head, and then I meet with somebody who's used to doing it in a much grander way. It was really just taking these makeshift ideas and elevating them in ways that I didn't know was possible. A lot of times they weren't, but we still somehow figured it out. I don't remember your question.
No, I think that's really spot on, Lydia. I don't know if you want to add to it, but it's just seeing where you were coming from, a director working with someone like Shane, and how you were able to bridge that gap from short film to long form.
Because the cool thing is, it's like we're different generations as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one thing that I always consider myself a 5-year-old. right? It's like I've never grown up past 5 years old. So, you know, any younger directors, I immediately bond with that generation, that time, because I try to soak up what your creativity like a sponge, and then I kind of shake it all up and try to figure out how to take it to the next level. Mm-hmm. And that was what was so inspiring to me, is because you're like, oh yeah, the Diego's going to talk. And I'm like, wait, what?
Diego's a puppet, by the way.
Yeah, Diego's a puppet in the story. And then all of a sudden you threw that down, like on our third 3 hour call. You're like, yeah, what if I think Diego should talk? And then he basically becomes your life coach throughout the whole film. Mm-hmm. And this was an element where when you said it, I was like, oh, hell yeah. Of course he's going to talk. You know, it's like, and you kept on pushing me to uncomfortable places that's my sweet spot. You know, that's where I love to always create from, something that you've not really done before. You're always trying to, my God, how can we reinvent the wheel? How can we, you know, slice it a new way? It's like, and as long as all that is done from the heart and the soul of the message of the film and the emotion, if we're doing that and we're only shining spotlights on that emotion and everything that we did, like, I'll never forget the other thing. It's like he would come up with these crazy ideas. He's like, but it would be, and there were curveballs, which was awesome, right? He's like, I want all the lights to turn off at Rutgers. And I was like, well, shit, I don't have anything that can turn off. I didn't plan on this. He goes, yeah, I want all the lights to turn off and a spotlight goes on me. And it's like, we had kind of talked about the spotlight, but not all the lights turning off. So then it's like, okay, so I got somebody over on a light switch, like literally on a light switch, you know?
Because I was like, why don't you just turn them off? And Shane's like, this is not how this works. It's not just turn it off and on. It's a little more complicated than that. And so like we would, in a weird way, educate each other. I would educate you on-
to just be simpler.
Just do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you'd educate me on no.
Right.
It's not possible. But there's this. So that was the other thing. You know, I joke, but I don't think I ever actually heard the words "it's not possible" or "no" or "I don't think so" from Shane. It was always yes. It was always yes and instead of no but. Other people's job was to say no, and there were some radical ideas that were being pitched. And considering the fact that we had 5 weeks and this much money and these parameters and these locations, it was a tall order, and there were a lot of unrealistic asks, but it was always yes. Mm-hmm. Shane was always saying, hell yeah, I love that idea. Let's do it. Let's figure it out. And if we can't do it, let's do it anyway. and that was exactly the approach. And I don't think we had to fight for certain pieces that, if it weren't for that attitude, would have never been pulled off.
I think that's a great testament to what the collaborative process should look like between a director and a DP. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's not a lot of communication of what that looks like historically. You know, those are the two most, to a certain degree, the two most important creative minds trying to steer this ship. And I love hearing that you guys were able to meet in the middle with stuff using your years of traditional Hollywood filmmaking, your newer generation of entering into the industry through social media platforms, but still an amazing filmmaker in your own right. I think that is just amazing to be able to see that today.
I agree, Brendan. And I think for those that don't know Rudy, and they've literally been living under a rock if they don't know your history on YouTube, but I think that you know, coming up and creating, directing on YouTube, really doing the music, being you, right? Doing it all. And then transitioning as a director to shooting your first feature film, there were so many interesting elements as an actor and a director and writer in all the roles that you played, from what taking your audience from YouTube, having them get excited about Musica, which is a much longer format. Mm-hmm. I think there's many elements that you were able to test drive, if you will, to check to see if it worked for this particular project on YouTube, and do a unusual way of like pre-screening it or friends and family screening. That is so brilliant and not done.
I've never seen a movie done like this. I mean, you were able to preconceive, shoot it, put it out there and see if it struck a chord. And if it did, you were like, okay, let's incorporate this into the movie. Right. And I was able to see how it worked prior as well, because you said, oh, well, I did this. Here's the video. I did this. Here's the video. And I would sit there and I would just look at it. I'm like, okay, so how, I love the DIY element to it. Let's still keep some of that essence.
But elevate it.
But mm-hmm. then elevate it.
Right.
And how can we do that? I've already seen it on YouTube. I already see the millions and millions of views. So we know this struck a chord. So how can we keep the soul of that mm-hmm. idea mm-hmm. and then just take it a little higher cinematically?
Yeah. No pun intended. Take it higher. At first, I think it was a subconscious effort, because I think a lot of people who have seen anything that I've done assume that social media and short form comes second nature to me. But I actually had to learn that form, because I fell in love with music and films far before videos on social media was a thing. I really had to learn that language. I'm still trying to learn it. I by no means have mastered it, because I don't think it's something that one can actually master, because mm-hmm. it's so mm-hmm. it's constantly changing and evolving. But I loved the challenge of telling a story in such a short amount of time, which is why I like the Vine format, 6 seconds. If you can tell a story in 6 seconds, that says something about your creativity. Mm-hmm. If you can make a compelling piece of music in 6 seconds, that says something about your songwriting. So I was attracted to that. And then 6 seconds grew to 15 seconds, grew to a minute, grew to 5 minutes, as all these different platforms started imposing video features. And then YouTube was an opportunity to make pretty much anything with very little parameters, which for a creative is a dream come true. Not the case with film and TV. You have studio, you have producers, you have a lot more cooks. That was an education for me. But to your point, it went from a subconscious thing to a strategy. I realized, what's my goal in life? It's to make films and music, and ideally do them both simultaneously. That's why I look up to Charlie Chaplin, because he would mm-hmm. write, direct, compose, actually edit and choreograph his own material. And I think it is possible to do that if what you're saying is if this what you're trying the message you're trying to convey is honest mm-hmm. to who you are. So I realized, what's the best way to defend myself and justify some of these ideas? Well, why don't I just do them and make sure that it resonates with people? So I want to say, like, at least half a dozen of the set pieces for the film are based off of pieces I've already made a version of. And then Shane helped me, and Patrick and the rest of the crew helped me figure out how to take that concept that has already been proven, but elevate it and cinematize it. And a lot of times it worked. That one or that we did, I have done a poor man's version of that. The puppets was a proven online comedy sketch.
Huge, mm-hmm. huge.
Series.
Engagement. Yeah.
So when I would write a joke and the studio would say, hypothetically, if they would say, I don't really understand that joke, let's try something else. Maybe there's an alt. I could show them hours of versions of that joke.
Unbelievable. And see, this is so unique.
It really is. And what I love about it is that I really want to talk about your process, Rudy, because I think that this is so unusual. And your process is that you're so multi-talented in a variety of ways, but also your brain works very quickly and you're 10 steps ahead, mm-hmm. and then having to come back if people don't understand or see what you see, because you truly have such a gift and I think have a little bit of a different lens maybe than the average person mm-hmm. in terms of creativity and the creative process. And so then it's having to come back and justify that with the numbers or with, you know, viewership, especially as a first time director. And I think that everybody, and I am not a director, so everybody who's first time director, I'm sure, has to justify a lot. And then getting that opportunity to direct again is even more pressure and incredibly difficult, especially if you've had a hit.
Right.
And I'm sure it's the same on YouTube, just in a different version, different numbers, right? But when you're dealing with studios, and my point is that you're seeing things. They're not convinced, especially with the winner or other things that you really had to fight for. Mm-hmm. And how did you, very practically for all the directors out there, go about doing it? And as a creative, saying, okay, I know this is going to work. How was that?
Tricky. Next question. No, I was very lucky. Amazon really believed in the vision. They believed in me. They really trusted me. And they saw the worth by analyzing years of material. I mean, I shot that short, mm-hmm. which is a version of the opening scene of the film, years before the film got greenlit. But it was a proof of concept that proved I can direct something that feels cinematic, not just something that feels like it was made for the internet. So Amazon really supported the vision, which was huge. And I got very lucky that I got such a badass crew because there were so many parameters. There was so much up against the project. Commanding a set isn't easy, but I love it. The hardest part was being in every scene as an actor. I felt that I sometimes could, and a testament to having a great crew, I felt that I couldn't be as present as I really wanted to be, mm-hmm. and command as significantly as I could have, because I also had to be in character, and I also had to be on camera and look a certain way and remember my lines. So I would have liked to spend more time at the tech scouts. And when we're at these certain locations, I had to either be there remotely or just trust that it was right. Trust the crew that it would be right. Because I was sitting with the actors going rewriting scenes as a writer, or I was rehearsing as an actor. That was probably the most challenging part, was directing this while also having to be the lead. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I'll ever do that ever again.
Did you direct yourself through scenes? Because I always know there's like Mel Gibson who would get a first AD who knows how to direct. So when he was on camera, like Braveheart, for example, the first AD was always there to help him through that. And knowing you've done so much content where you are acting and directing it, what does that process look like? Or do you try to get someone else to help you, or is like Shane in that chair?
Well, I did rely very heavily on people like Shane, like my sister, who's like my right-hand woman. She was sitting at Video Village, and I'd have to rush over to Village and look at her. And based off her expression, I could tell if we got it or not. And I would do the same thing. I'd run over to Shane's little tent, and I'd be like, what do you think? Did we get it? Because, you know, and he would, and sometimes he would put a bit of a director's hat and say, mm-hmm. it looked great. I would get one more because of A, B, and C. You don't want to waste the time of watching playback after every take. So sometimes you just have to trust the energy of the moment and trust the energy of the crew. And that's something that I was used to by just making videos. But mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest distinction between making a film and making a video, is that everything is bigger.
Yeah.
Time mm-hmm. is more valuable. There are more heads and bodies on set. There's more gear. Every minute counts. I don't have to tell you that time is probably by far the most valuable asset.
Yeah.
More than money or credits or talented people is actually time. Like, time was the thing that we were fighting for the most.
And it's like, I think as a director of photography, going into a movie like this, where he was the writer, director, actor, composer, I thought to myself, I tried to put that hat on and see how I could function with making all the day-to-day, scene-to-scene, directing, you know, thinking about the script, thinking about the writing, trying to, you know, remember my lines, all that stuff. And I said, oh my God, how I can help Rudy more than anything is to literally shot list and schematic every single scene. So we talked it through. We designed the shot list in those meetings and continued to finesse it as locations changed and things, you know, curveballs came up. But you knew each day you got a document, and that document showed where we had discussed that, where you were going and where the other characters were going and the shot list around it. So you could, I wanted to just clear as much of that noise away from you so you could be your most present in regards to delivering the performance and also not having to think about, oh, did we get all the coverage? Did forget that? Did you know? Because when you start doing that, that's going to only make you trip and fall on other things.
Yeah. So I had that safety net.
And that's huge. And I think let's dive into that. So as the non-cinematographer in the group, how did you make creative choices in terms of gear? Everybody wants to know.
Rules of engagement, I think, are really important.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was one thing that we, when we talked about, I was like, you know, having the characters have these kind of rules, you know, and we kind of created different color tones for the characters. Yeah. So, you know, Isabella's character, the Brazilian, was more golden and oranges and reds in her space. And then we wanted her to feel a little more raw.
Handheld and grainy.
So we added we shot at 3200 ISO on the Gemini to gain that beautiful texture for day exteriors. Night, it didn't matter what it was. Mm-hmm. We shot 3200 and you could see it, you know, so I knew we were going down a really good road when you saw the iron-bound backdrop and how that grain worked in the fish market, in the park, and all on the street scenes. It just brought a texture to it that felt Isabella.
And what were what did you shoot on?
So we shot on the Red Gemini, which I think is one of the most amazing full, you know, kind of multi-format kind of camera, because it's dual ISO. So it gives you an amazing clean feed at 800, and then you can go 1600 or 3200 with its dual ISO, and it gives you a beautiful grain to the image. And because it's more of a Super 35 sensor, the photo buckets are so much bigger. Mm-hmm. So it really feels like filmic grain. It's not a tight sensor like the Helium, where it's 8K pushed into a Super 35, envelope. It is a larger format, in 4K. So it's not trying to put all those 8Ks of pixels in there that are super tight. It's got room to breathe.
Yeah.
And I felt that using the dual ISO and then the combination with the Leica Summicron glass, which is not pristine, it has quirks. You know, it's it distorts a little bit. It has a character. It's not just clean. So when we were discussing the movie on how we could develop the color structure, so Haley's character, she was from Montclair. She was upper crust. We wanted her to have this kind of hyper white kind of feel. Mm-hmm. And we wanted her to be super clean. So we...
And almost clinical at times.
Clinical, yeah. That's exactly right. It felt almost like you were in a hospital room everywhere she was.
And which is... But it's a testament to her character, you know? Her character represents a safe version.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A safe direction that Rudy could take. And what safer than static, clean, no grain, no dirt,
a
hyperbolic version of that was important. But that, you know, this is an example of an impossible ask that I had that Shane made possible.
This was thinking so far out of the box that I was like, wow. And this is where I loved how you challenged me. So we had a scenario.
That's a polite way of putting it.
Where we had a whole location, the Brasilia.
Jesus, I forgot about this.
Right? So we had the dining side, and then we had the bar side. And the dining side, I lit all cold, super hyper white. And because all three of his, you know, love interests are going to collide in this film. Mm-hmm. Haley is in this very kind of more clinically based, restaurant, which it's really hard to create that in that kind of space because it's all color and warmth and all this thing that counteract the shit out of what we were trying to do. But I was able to make this really kind of, you know, hyper white environment on one side of the restaurant. And then when he walked to the bathroom and ran into Isabella, that side was lit with mica shades and really warm and gold and red tones and everything.
And we were off of the sticks for that.
Yes. Yeah. We all went handheld.
So
you know,
was more fluid. Mm-hmm.
Well, her side was all locked in. His side or her side, Isabella's side. So Haley's side, all locked,
tight.
Very tight, you know, mm-hmm. constricted. And we used a series of like longer lenses and got back, so it kind of compressed the background, so he felt like he was in a box when he was with her. And then when we went to Isabella's side, we were wider lenses, pushed in close, more intimate. So it's like we already, these rules of engagement of how we would tackle it, not only from a lighting standpoint, not only from a color standpoint, not only from a grain standpoint, it was from a focal distance standpoint. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and of course you can't expect the audience or me to understand any of this. However, you feel it.
100%.
You absolutely feel it.
At least I hope that people feel a sense of anxiety in certain moments and ease in other moments. And I think that it's highly attributed to this science.
Yes.
So if it wasn't enough for me to ask, could we give the different characters their own shooting style and color temperature? But could we also make it happen at the same location in the same scene? So he did it. He somehow figured out how to do it practically, as he just said. Half of this restaurant. Oh, and do it in the restaurant that the authentic restaurant that I grew up going to.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. it had to be that space. So there was a number of challenges, but he literally split the restaurant in half and we divided it with that bar.
Right.
The island. Half of it was lit and conceived one way and colored one way and the other half another way. And it was all done practically. This isn't some post color effect or filter. And then you have the piano player who's in the middle, who somehow has to embody a little bit of both. He was like this neutral. I don't know how you do it. And I apologize again for putting you through that, but it makes
sense. What I think is so great about that, and that's like a testament to Shane too, is you really understand the psychological bits, because sure, I think studios executives don't think that those components of filmmaking really matter because it might go over people's head. But I really combat that notion mm-hmm. and say, mm-hmm. even just as a general audience member, they do feel the nuances between the different color temperature, different focal length. And that's what makes creativity so expressive. And assuming that your audience can keep up is always the best thing, rather than thinking they're too dumb to keep up. And I always try to tell that to filmmakers, challenge them, try to do things that are nuanced, get into the subtextual like characteristics of cinematography. And I think that was one point when we were watching it a little bit over a year ago. And this is something I would love to hear you talk about, is just composition alone. There's so many great compositional elements, whether it be the transitions. Where were those coming from? Were they inspired by previous films? I know you're talking about mm-hmm. Charlie Chaplin, which is a great example of that. But Shane, what was some of the stuff just compositionally you were thinking about with this film?
Yeah, I mean, I started watching a lot of Rudy's work once, mm-hmm. you know, we said, okay, we're going to go do this. And one of the things that I loved about what he had done is so much of what his content was classic, great filmmaking. Mm-hmm. In camera, classic filmmaking that can only succeed if you actually have a plan, mm-hmm. right? And I'm talking like the simplicity of a match cut, which you do not see in movies because it requires us to have a plan from beginning to end, right? It's not something that can just say, oh yeah, let's try the match cut thing. Mm-hmm. It has to go. And then he came to me and he goes, all right, this is what I'm thinking with this match cut stuff. And I'm like, oh my God, this is going to give the audience the emotional grind of what you're going through every day. And how can we accent that? And he goes, well, with the match cut, it's like all of a sudden he's in the kitchen eating breakfast. And then all of a sudden he's match cut to the bus. Match cut.
Yeah,
to Rutgers.
It should all feel like one long piece because the character feels like he's a victim of the situations that he self mm-hmm. perpetuates, and that was. If we didn't do a match cut or a transition for the sake of it, be a practical transition for the sake of it being cool.
Exactly.
It was very much to reflect what the character was going through. So when he falls. In the train station platform into his bed, it's because I feel that this character feels like they're falling mm-hmm. into bed and then it's morning. It's like, where did the night go? My life is 10 steps ahead of my brain. That's something that we had to, as you said, plan for. You know, we never went from A to B.
No.
Without some kind of connective musical and visual tissue.
Correct.
And I love that. And let's get into a practical shoot day for 1 second, because I think what's so interesting to me is the musical thread and doing the live music, having your sound designer there, mm-hmm. Getting the cut that you and your rhythm specialist, I believe Shane was telling me, the rhythm.
Yeah, rhythm performer is what we called it, which is, we had to invent that term because what they were doing they weren't quite dancing, weren't quite playing instruments. They were just grabbing forks and knives and brooms and turning it into music. So we had to invent a role called rhythm performer. So
yeah, cut you it'd off. Never been actually done.
And they're extraordinary. They are extraordinary. It's like the best of musical theater, dancing, and rhythm all in one human.
Oh, man. When I was going with Jamie and he's like, hey, I'm going to the kitchen supply store down in Newark. And I go, wait, what? Yeah, I'm finding pots and pans that I can tune to the beat. And I'm like,
yeah.
So this is a whole other level. And this is
of
like
music.
It was so unique that you're literally finding. And when they altered the chopping stations for the fish, mm-hmm. that had it. When you hit to the side, they added a sound dimension in that. So it had the right tone when they hit it.
Because we were recording everything live. And all these performers were either stompers or ex-stompers or from street. Drum corps, they're quite literally the best people in the world to turn any situation or miscellaneous object into an instrument. And you know, we'd be asked quite often, like, what's the point in tuning that pot to a B flat? And it's because we're recording it live. And then the next question would be, why? Typically, that's something that's done very easily later.
Later.
Why record it live on the day and waste hours?
Yeah, we had pre-mics, not pre-lights.
How many mics were deployed just to cover a scene at times?
Oh, man. It was 99 like... was the top.
Wait, was there a 99 at one point?
99.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, the reason for it was to really do what you were just saying, was mm-hmm. try to capture the on-the-day practical sounds that these items were producing. You can recreate them and you can refine them, of course, later. But it's just not the same hearing the room and the swing and the energy. And it was different, slightly different every take. It was really important that we capture all this stuff. We were scoring and composing while we were shooting, which is not typically
how this is done. Which is never done. And I was going to say, it energetically, I imagine, for everybody on set, there's such a, because I love energy and that's my obsession, there's such a vibrancy that occurs and actually a shift with live music. Mm-hmm. That, and again, I come from a musical background and I love music. I think that, you know, I think of a yoga studio just with singing bowls and how it mm-hmm. shifts the energy of the chakras.
Totally. It's real. Frequency is a real thing that's emitted when you produce sound, and frequency affects matter.
It affects matter.
And our physicality.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so having the live music, as this was your story and this is who you are, you play music as a musician daily, just like, you know, as part of your artistic outlet, mm-hmm. I think brought an authenticity, I would imagine, to what you were trying to convey of what it's like to be you, in a whole different way. And I think that from your standpoint, Shane, it's so complicated because Rudy has so much going on, right, in your head, in your mind, and the way that you relate to your environment, let's say, and as a musician. And so that took up a big chunk of the day. Hmm. And then once you got that, once everybody signed off on the music, then your time to shoot it was severely crunched because of the live performance that was necessary to be authentic to you, Rudy. So it's a juxtaposition.
Oh, yeah. It's like when I went into that diner set and they were doing the pre-mic, we were told that we had to work outside. So my pre-rigging team had to do everything outside the first 2 days because they're in there pre-miking. And we didn't want them to, you know, trip on cables or anything like that. And then when I finally went there to kind of start to finesse the pre-light, I went back around the corner because the diner was like a long, and then it had this big eating area that we were able to hide, you know, people in. And I walked in, and this soundboard was like walking into a master suite at like Warner Brothers Center. And I was like, what the hell? Right? I thought he was going to lay in like, you know, four shotguns and call it a day. And he's got the cashier. He's like got all these little mics, and they've, you know, they really hid them well to the point where we couldn't see them.
Yeah.
So that was so like, it really started to, you know, check a lot of boxes of, I've never done this before, you know?
It was the only way in my mind. Oh. I mean, if you're going to claim to want to make a film about that is told through a synesthetic lens where senses are intertwined and you're not sure what's diegetic, what's non-diegetic,
exactly,
what's in our narrator's head and what isn't, you better mic the shit out of that room.
It's almost as if you're capturing reality. If you really think about it, what's happening on that day is what the audience is going to experience.
Exactly.
And you want to bridge that gap because, again, I think the audience can really tell. The more you manufacture, the mm-hmm. more you like prune it and manipulate it in post, the more they're going to feel that manufactured process. And I think that really brings the audience close to the story that you both were trying to tell.
Yeah, it's to me a difference between listening to a song and watching the song be performed live. It's a different energy, and it's a different experience, and it's more immersive, and you can feel the low end inside of your gut in a way that no top of the line speaker could produce.
No, and the also, it fueled the hell out of my team too, because, you know, I wanted to get them as passionate about this project mm-hmm. as I was. So, you know, I showed him the sizzle. I showed him as much of Rudy's work that we were doing. So they really kind of understood, you know, I said, you got to jump into this guy's mind because it's going to be a fucking hell of a ride. Yeah. Right. And that was so engaging, and people were so invested in it that You know, I saw ACs trying to figure out when the key grip didn't deliver the rig that would do, you know, move you into the bed, and the ACs all of a sudden pulling out his little Sackler or the cartoony thing and building this all and making it work. And then you're like, wow, this is, they are invested. Mm-hmm. And it really was, it was so much fun to, when those performers started to,
oh, I can imagine,
create that percussion. It was like, I'll never forget it. Like, it brought me back to Drumline. Mm-hmm. I remember being in a tunnel, and I had envisioned the USC tunnel, you know, that beautiful, you know, mm-hmm. hook that the band comes out of and comes onto the thing. I thought that's what it was going to be like. So I go to Clark, Atlanta, where we shot the whole movie, and it's literally a hallway like it's in our office.
Yeah. And then, yeah. And it's up to you to
make that look good. Right. And I was like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? I go, all right, what if I pack them all into this hallway, create all these little, you know, streaks of light. And then all of a sudden, when he goes, walks out and he goes, all right, halftime is game time. And he walks out. And then all of a sudden, this stick flies up into the foreground and literally pierces the frame. And then it goes, ka, ka, ka. And then the whole band erupts. Everyone around me had earplugs in because it was like in that tunnel, it was like, you know, being a projectile of sound, right? It hits you like a wave. And I never put my earplugs in. I wanted to feel that every single time. That's why I can't hear shit now.
But
you know, and I don't know if I ever told you this, but Drumline was a film that made me want to join the percussion ensemble when I was in school.
No way.
Yeah, yeah. I saw that film and I was like, oh, drumming and being in the school band can actually be cool.
Right.
And I joined percussion ensemble and band. Turns out I was right. It wasn't cool at all. It was a lot it was a lot cooler in the movie. Yeah, it was very inspirational, Drumline, to me. So to connect that dot many years later and be able to work with the person who shot it, I mean, it's insane. It's a dream come true. And I also remember you describing that big set piece, that final battle at the end in that stadium.
Yeah.
And I was like, what was that like, being in that stadium with thousands of people? And Shane's like, there's no one there.
Right.
It was empty. There was no one there. There was all this trick photography I came up with to create the illusion of there being a full stadium with mm-hmm. lights and with the flashes from the cameras. And I couldn't believe it. Between what you did and the sound design, you certainly had me fooled.
I love that so much.
Yeah.
So Rudy, let's talk music for a minute, because you just referenced it. How many instruments do you actually play?
I don't know. Bunch.
So,
well, it all started with piano. Piano was like the foundational instrument right. for me.
Okay.
But through piano, which is technically a percussion instrument, I became obsessed with percussion and drumming, and it was kind of an easy transition for me. And then I picked up a guitar and started teaching myself that, some bass, you know,
ukulele,
forks, brooms.
Whatever you can find.
Yeah, whatever I could find.
Have you been classically musically trained, or
no.
Is it all self-taught?
It's pretty much self-taught. I tried to take lessons, piano lessons, and I did them for like maybe a year. My parents put me in piano lessons, but I was such a poor student. I would never practice, and I had a really hard time learning how to read music. I spent a lot of hours playing, but almost no time practicing. So, so no, I'm not. Although I understand from basic level most music theory, it's all self-taught. And it's not because I thought I was better than a teacher, because I'm trying to be pompous. It was simply because I had a major learning disability. I like could not focus. I refused to practice. My attention, as you see in the movie, was at a very short lifespan. So yeah, music was just made sense to me as long as I can remember. It just made sense
as just a creative outlet, as a relaxing. Because yeah. Our son, I relate to this so much. Our son Miles. I tried forever with music lessons. It was a disaster. He's all self-taught, mm-hmm. and he's all self-taught by ear. And
that was me.
And he would, hears it, and then all of a sudden he's tuning it, and then he'll find it.
Mm-hmm. I know that very well.
Yeah. And I find that so extraordinary. And I did the piano lessons, the whole deal, but I don't have that musical gift of being able to teach myself just based on hearing the notes. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the authenticity of that is so beautiful. And that's why I want to bring it up, because I think that from a very young age, you've been authentically yourself, and your expression and the way that you creatively express just comes out through music. And I see the same thing with our son, where in his downtime, he's just grabbing a guitar and playing.
Yeah.
Because it's soothing and it relaxes his nervous system, which is so wired.
And it just makes sense.
It makes sense to him.
There's no real explanation or rhyme or reason. It just is.
Yes.
You couldn't sit me in an orchestra and put a piece of music in front of me. I wouldn't know what to do.
Yeah.
I couldn't play a single note. But if I hear it, then I can play it back.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so back to the other authenticity question that I have. So having synesthesia, and maybe you could just explain a little bit about this, because I think it's so important for people to understand. Do you feel that the movie really captured your authentic experience of living with that? And what has that been like for you? Because again, your greatest genius, your greatest gifts also come with things that are, as you said, learning disabilities, not being able to focus, not being able to concentrate. I think that that is hopefully changing for people in terms of acceptance and the way that we do schooling and everything. But
right.
Do you feel that the movie really captured that essence of what it's like to live with that?
That's a great question. Synesthesia, firstly, for those who don't know, is a neurological condition whereby one sense will involuntarily stimulate another sense. You can almost consider it like an intertwining of the senses. And what I didn't realize that at the time that I was diagnosed, if you will, was how many different iterations of the condition there were. There's like 100 types of synesthesia and growing. Some synesthetes can taste 14. Some synesthetes can smell Tuesday. It's this really interesting crosswiring of the senses. The type that I have and I've identified with is what I've based on my research, what I've known to be called rhythmic association. This is also another type, linguistic personification, which apparently is very common for people who speak multiple languages. They can personify certain inanimate ideas or numbers or objects. The most common type is chromesthesia.
That's the color one, right?
Correct. Yeah. Whereby people perceive sound as color and color as sound. So a lot of musicians, like from Etta James to Pharrell to Billie Eilish, have a form of chromesthesia where they don't think of it as C major to B flat. They think of it as blue to yellow. It's super interesting. It's very fascinating. I feel like we're barely scratched the surface of what's possible in a synesthetic perspective. But for me, it's like almost like a musical OCD, if you will. Rhythmic association is trying to organize sounds, everyday regular sounds, into some sort of rhythm or musical foundation.
At what age did you know that you had this? Was it pretty young that you had this diagnosis, or
no? That happened actually later, and it's because it's not as commonly mm-hmm. talked about, mm-hmm. and there isn't so much information and evidence to support it. But increasingly now, I see more and more of it. I knew that my brain worked in a very interesting way from a very young age, but I just thought that I was a weirdo. I didn't know that there was a community of people that shared these symptoms. I didn't know that there was a name for it. I just figured, sounds can be really intense for me. I tried to count everything and turn everything into like a metronomic rhythm. And now I've learned how to kind of cope with it. But like from a very young age, I would quite literally, what you're seeing in the opening scene of the film where I missed an entire conversation was very commonplace. It would happen all the time. It's probably why I didn't have a lot of friends.
Oh my God, I can imagine that in school. How the hell do you concentrate?
Just a lot of Fs on the report card. and then later, I made a lot of friends and I figured out how to cope with this thing. But I was lucky. I'm lucky that I was able to turn this weird thing into an asset and use it to create.
To create creative art. And how would it impact relationships? Because I can only imagine.
Yeah, because that's a good one, because that's what this love story
is about.
The story is about. So let's dive into that. I love that.
That's
it's got
a
hot in here, didn't it?
No. No, but I'm just thinking parentally, like to start with your parents, it's like, are you listening? You know, are you paying attention? How many, you know, as the parent, right? Thinking that your kid is constantly tuning you out, but they're not.
Right.
They're just in their head.
Yeah. I mean, I think at home it was probably the most comfortable place, because, you know, they're very accepting of
and
who
loving.
I was. Yeah. And I, they were supportive of the musical mind and the creative mind. I'm thankful for that. It was really everyone outside of home that was the trickier part. You know, Brazilians, I feel are naturally have a musicality to them. Even the language itself, Portuguese Brazilian, to the average ear, it actually sounds quite musical.
Mm-hmm.
It does this a lot. And the intonations are really specific. And music is such a heavy part of Brazilian culture that as far as I think like my mom was concerned, everything was normal with me. This is like, of course you're distracted.
That.
You know, of course you're thinking in terms of music. Who doesn't? Well, it turns out most of the world doesn't. relationships were kind of very difficult to sustain. I don't think I got into my first actual serious relationship until I was in college. And what you see in the film, not that Haley and or Isabella are based on real people. They're both based on ideas of people and a culmination of people that I had relationships with. And it was a serious problem was my attention, was my focus, still is. But I've got lucky that I've met people in my life who embrace that side of me rather than resent it.
That's really important because I feel like there's so much culture in itself looks at it very binary. Mm-hmm. I actually had a very similar experience. My mom's Colombian and I would always be in the principal's office because I was tapping, drawing and doing everything but what my teachers wanted me to do. And they're like, listen, Christina, my mom and my dad, we're going to have to hold him back. He's just not formulating in with the students. He's very much by himself. And I was very much a loner. Like I would always be drawing, playing with stuff, building things. My mom was like, no, that's just his creativity.
Exactly.
Don't squash his creativity. Just because he isn't doing what you want him to doesn't mean he's any less valuable to the classroom.
Totally.
And I think that's really important for people to hear because even today we have such, and it's really important, mental health is super important, but just because you're feeling some stuff, remember that might be your most creative part of you.
Yes.
And don't try to squander it because you might not fit in. And I think that's something I actually struggled with later on because I didn't find myself in other people and I did choose to like crush it for a little bit. But I think that's a really important thing. It's look at you, who you found, how to harbor it, control it, make it be part of like one of the best parts of you. And I think that's really important for people to hear.
Yeah. I mean, and it's why, you know, supportive mothers and parents or those kinds of figures are so important. I was very similar. Everything you just described sounds, sounds very
and it's
similar.
Hard to go through. It's definitely not easy to go through.
No, I had a lot of that as well. I didn't have a lot of friends either. And I was always kind of the
oddball
odd guy out, you know, and I found a very small collection of friends that were still very, you know, connected still now.
Mm-hmm.
But those were, you know, the four or five people in my life that basically was my, you know, my lighthouse, my guiding, you know, along with my mom understood me a lot more than my dad. And my dad, it took so long for him to really, like, I would say, hey, I got my newest movie and I got nominated for it and everything. He goes, you know, I thought you were going to go to Cornell. And I thought you were going to be a, you know, I thought you were going to be a writer or something like that. And I'm like, yeah, but Dad, this is me being a cinematographer and everything. And it took Need for Speed, where I was sitting in the theater with him And he turned to me and he goes, "That's a keeper."
Nah, and you got the approval.
And that was the first time I got approval. And I was, what, 48 or something? That's
awesome. Yeah, I'm still waiting for mine. One day. But I don't know if this was the case for you guys, but it used to be a lot worse. I think as you maybe age and mature and things fall into perspective and you learn how to cope and... you know, I'm able to sit here right now and have a conversation with you guys. But like 10 years ago, I would have, you know, general meetings. I'd move to Hollywood. I signed with an agency and I'd go meet with this studio or that production company or that producer. And a lot of the times, you know, your agents call you afterwards, tell you how the meeting went or how the pitch went. Like, yeah, they liked you. They were a little bit concerned about your drug problem. I was like, what? I was like, well, you were just, you know, you were clearly on something in the meeting and they were a little bit like, yeah, I hope he's okay. I was like, I'm not on anything. They're like, well, half of Hollywood thinks you have a drug problem because you don't sit still. You get up at random times and I couldn't control it.
Because you couldn't sit. And I totally understand.
Couldn't sit, tapping. You know, that person said something that kind of sounded like, you know, it could be a little beat. And it's
right.
It was a nightmare. People thought that I was out of my mind because I am.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. I had that quite a bit where people would be like, "Brendan, what do you smoke?" And I'm like, "Listen, I'm not sober because the way that I think is very much like B to A. And I love going down into these like rabbit holes." And I would always explain stuff and I would get, "Man, this guy's like trying to be too heady or he's trying to like go too far with it." And that's always been my biggest criticism. It's like, "Brendan, why do you have to be so deep about everything?" And I'm like, "I don't know. It's like, that's kind of just what I want to talk about." But yeah, I got like 7 years ago, it would be super hard to even come to this city, which you think it would be the case, but I'm like very much a cinephile and just being super expressive about movies, be like, "What's your favorite movie? Oh, I love this about Tarkovsky or this about Altman," whatever it might be. And people hate that for some reason. I always thought that was so like disheartening for me. Is the more the like, maybe the best way to say it, the more you burn, the brighter you are. It's really hard for people to adopt that about you sometimes.
And I think that having, and I love this vulnerable conversation that we're having, because I think what happens so much is that people silence themselves or they don't feel able to fully express, which is so painful as an artist and as a creative. And we've seen the results of that, right? We have seen the awful results of the suicide epidemic and all of these horrible things happening. So I think that this message is so important to embrace your own path, to realize that all of these unique qualities and differences really mean that there might not be a perfect path for you to follow, but you can create your own. And I think, Rudy, you've done that so brilliantly, not only with your YouTube channel, but with this first feature film, to try to break down the walls and the barriers of differences and of, you know, how to be a creative and to show people so vulnerably how to fully be expressed as an artist in a way that feels so true to you as a Brazilian American with synesthesia, musician, writer, everything that you do. But it's such a testament to bringing this story to life. And I think, Shane, you have certainly created your own path in not only on a variety of feature films, but just in your own life, right? As an educator, as a working Hollywood cinematographer, as giving back to the next generation. And Brendan, you have as well. You know, you've had such a unique and unusual path in your life, and you have created the position that you now inhabit.
Yeah.
And so I think that this is very important for people to hear. And thank you so much, Rudy. I think this is a great, very inspiring way to kind of tie all this up.
Well, the message of the film is just that: be true to yourself. Mm-hmm. And he is constantly being pulled left and right and center with, you know, "No, you need to do this path. No, you need to do that path." And that was something that we as filmmakers wanted to really try to show. So we talked about kind of all the different characters having their, you know, colors and grain and all this stuff. But the mom character, which was played by Rudy's real mom.
I love your mom. Right?
And we were like, okay. And he talked to me about this. He goes, you know, my mom was very controlling. You know, she wanted me to, you know, this kind of over-lovingly Brazilian mom,
yeah.
right? Mm-hmm. That thinks that they're, you know, guiding you down the right path because they just love you so much.
Right.
And we were like, well, how can we show that, not just with dialogue, but how can we physically start to show that?
Mm-hmm.
And we came up with, and I think this was day one of our 3-hour, you know, shot listing, you know, brain dumps, mm-hmm. was this moment of when you fell into bed, because we had all seen these shots. We've all seen the ones where you follow the person like this.
Yeah.
Right.
What's the, is there a name for this kind of shot?
The like orbital arching,
because I guess it's technically like
there
a
definitely is a name.
A
rainbow rig. It's yeah, kind of like a rainbow shot.
Yeah, right. Rainbow shot, because it's 180, right? It's a 180.
Yeah.
Ours was 180. Yeah, it was. Yeah. Yeah.
But
we've seen it before.
We've yeah. seen it before, but none of those ever moved.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, so we do this. We've seen that. It's cool, but how can we take it to another level? So we did this. So, you know, we're horizontal. He falls, we go boom, like this. So now the image is going like this way, right? 9x16, basically. And then we pull out, because I've never seen any of those move because they're on this elaborate rig. We were able to put the elaborate rig on a dolly and then pull back and reveal a door that we cut in half, painted black, and mom knocks on the door. And Rudy is in bed on the other side. And the way this turned out, so as we started to go back, we spun this way. So when we rotated, she was on top of you.
Yeah.
Knocking. And we were like, this is a wonderful emotion to show this controlling mom
yeah.
on top of Rudy. And it's like, when we came up with that idea, this is when I felt that my mind and all the crazy shit that I've always wanted to try was like, you open the box.
And how much of that was discovered? I know you guys did a lot of prepping, but did you guys leave room to discover that? Like that shot specifically, did you know what was going to be that going into the day, or did you really find that movement
on the
when
day.
You're on set?
Yeah, I'd say it was a combination of both. It
yes.
was, it was very well prepared.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you on the day, you notice things, and there are sure. certain obstacles or limitations that
yeah,
you
like when the camera went on the side, I tried my best to make sure we had ceiling pieces
yeah,
and all
exactly.
that stuff. But then
and create
we saw
the depth behind the mom and all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and we saw off the set. We're like, oh shit, you yeah. know, we're gonna have to tilt down more, or you're just gonna have to paint that shit out. You know, we got so frustrated at one point because we would nail the scene and get back, and then I'd see off the set,
and that was all one move, right? From
yes.
the falling into bed, pulling out to reveal mom horizontally, pushing back in afterwards, and going back to the other way.
Exactly. But and while that was all going on, we went from night to dawn to morning.
Oh, that's right. And back. Because that was done in the studio.
Yes.
I forgot about that. And while that was going on, my mom couldn't remember the lines.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
That's awesome.
But and all these like cues and that's what was so what I loved about going on this journey with Rudy is we took a fantastical level of realism.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, from the oneer where, you know, everyone's like, it was so funny because I remember in a lot of test screenings, everyone's like, what is this? And, you know, all this, Jesus Christ, well, I didn't understand what that, it was a lot of people kissing and walking through these sets that appeared and everything. And I'm like, guys, you got to understand this. We're going into Rudy's mind, right? And these are layers.
People were definitely confused.
Yeah. Oh, they were. Yeah, it took.
But I don't know about you. That excited me. Not that I want to confuse viewers, but anytime somebody sees something, it's like I'm not quite sure how to feel about it. I think I translate that as it's fresh.
The greatest exactly. films are polarizing. And Nicholas Winding Refn, a lot of people always talk about that. You never want people to just love a movie because then they'll forget it. People that say, I love it, I hate it, I really like this. Criticism, film criticism is always at the heart of everything, and it's good. And I actually want to talk about that because test screenings are really hard. What were you thinking going into it, and what were you both feeling going out of it, and where the film was going to go from there? Just because I feel like not a lot of people talk about just the anticipation of doing a test screening as mm-hmm. a filmmaker.
I hated the whole process.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a blanket statement. I understand the value and why test screenings are done and why they're important. I became a little bit allergic to that process.
Yeah.
Two reasons. A, it wasn't a proper test screening. We were watching it over our laptops, over Zoom.
Yeah.
Because of COVID, no one yeah. was in an actual theater, which one could say is even better because they're going to give you the harshest review possible. But I'm relying on this person with their Wi-Fi connection mm-hmm. in their homes who are distracted by God knows what to evaluate my first movie. That's scary.
Yeah.
So there was that part of it, which I wish we had all been in a theater and judged yeah. it that way, where you heard it with supreme sound and a big screen. We didn't get that. But it was highly educational. There was a focus group afterwards with yeah. a moderator where you got to actually hear people talk through it. And the more they talked through it, the more I realized, oh, wow, they were really actually engaged. They were really intrigued, engaged. They had a lot of questions. They enjoyed talking about their questions and concerns. And that was the more valuable part of the experience. But the part I didn't like about it was the, I guess the movie making systemic approach to it, which is like, this is what you have to do. This is the conditioning. You have to do a test screening, and depending on how it scores, mm-hmm. will determine whether or not you should change things, make editorial changes, do reshoots. I didn't like that it was a test screening that was determining the fate of the film.
For sure.
And I also didn't like when I was told by some people, like, your film's only as good as the test screenings, right? It's like, if it doesn't test well, then the quality must not be as high as it can be. What's the point of making the film you want to make if no one's going to like it? And my answer to that is, well, I was being honest.
Right.
The film's going to live forever. The review won't. I have to be able to be really proud of this thing. So our film tested not great.
No.
Because people were a bit confused.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I have to tell you that, so I'm an empath. I have
it got better, by the way. It tested better because we did reshoots and all the stuff. And, you know, but luckily the studio and stuff was on board with the test. This is more a formality and more of an opportunity for us to get a conversation going and pick up on a few things, but by no means does it dictate the fate of your film. And I feel for filmmakers who have a more rigid experience, because a lot of times test screenings do determine
yes.
yeah.
the film. And I'm sorry to cut you off.
No, but I think that's so important. And I was going to say, when you watch it, there's so much going on mm-hmm. that if you're really in tune and like I felt for your character mm-hmm. through all of the tension, the anxiety, the emotional roller coaster of dealing with these women and his mom. I mean, I was actually emotionally exhausted at the end of this because I was
good.
So invested.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say.
No, but it's really true. And I said to Shane, I'm like, I'm exhausted after but I think that if you're going on that journey, it's a lot to pay attention to. It is a lot for people to understand.
And it's a shorter film, too.
Right.
I mean,
it's
what
a
is
tight
it?
90 minutes, 91
yeah, it's
minutes.
It's 91
tight.
Minutes.
And it's exciting. And you feel just such a range of emotions, or at least I can only speak for myself. I did. Right? I did. It was, it's an emotional journey. And so I think that's part of the test screening too, right? Is every person is coming into it being where they're at and maybe empathizing more like myself or having had a rough day, somebody having had an amazing day and falling in love. So they're like, oh my God, I love this movie because, you know, it's a love story, right? Like it really depends on where the person's
the psyche's mindset of, you know, where they are.
Yeah. I'd be curious to hear, like, do you have a different way that you wish that process could be done? Because I feel like all of Hollywood's under evaluation. A lot of these, like, legacy systems really do need to be kind of not destroyed but refined, because the directorial perspective I feel like has been closed or hampered so much by committee-based filmmaking.
Yeah,
I would love to hear what your approach is.
Well, once the film's out there and you know it's released, the truth is it's none of my business anymore. It's actually not mine anymore. It's yours. And whatever it makes you feel, and whatever you have to say, and whatever criticism, I embrace. I made videos on the internet for years. I've been called every single name you could possibly imagine. Nothing offends me. I know I made the best thing that I could with what we had, and that'll always be true. I wish that we tested the film in a theater, though. I wish that all these hundreds of people got to see this film for the first time with pristine sound and visuals, and not, you know, on a laptop or phone in their bedroom or dorm room.
Yeah.
That's no way to watch a film for the first time.
No, and the feedback we got, you know, remember when they were like, well, you know, people are not liking Rudy so much. And we
I was like, good, that's a point. I don't like myself either.
Exactly. And we're like,
but that was a big one. Yeah. A big one was like Rudy's likability.
Exactly. Like, and then all of a sudden Diego's through the roof. We need more Diego, right? And then we had to dream up more scenes with Diego, right? And we actually, you know, in our pickups where we went in, we shot a lot of
more with the puppet Diego.
With that.
So that was a win. Like good things come from test screens, of course. They're valuable. I didn't love that.
This style.
Yeah. It would have been nice to have been in a theater.
Yeah, of course.
And had a real conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, moving forward, you're going to see a lot more of what you just experienced because it is expensive to do all these things.
Totally.
And now, you know, now that streaming has really taken hold and the theater going perspective is on the downturn, which is unfortunate. You're going to start to see that the small screen is where they're going to be experiencing it. And this, and your movie's got to perform well on that small screen because that's the captive audience. And, you know, I start to think about, you know, when we go to make movies, it's like we have 3 minutes to grab the audience now with the streaming platform. When
used to be 15, 20.
Yeah. When you're in a theater, you're kind of in there. You've got your popcorn, you've sat committed, you've obviously gotten in your car and gone to the theater. And now, you know, for you to pull out at that point.
That's right.
It's a little more difficult. It's like, I can count how many times on both hands, how many times I've walked out of a movie theater, right? But how many times have you jumped from seeing a trailer or the first 2 or 3 minutes of a film, and then you say, screw this, I'm going to something else.
Yeah, on streaming or on digital, mean?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely made that level of investment lower.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think the way Rudy conceptualized the film, it starts with a humdinger. Like it starts with like, oh my God, what am I on a ride for?
That's a very nice, optimistic way of putting it. Some people might watch the first 2 minutes and be like, I'm getting the hell out of here.
I love it. Well, we are so excited for, and again, congratulations, just to reiterate for everybody, Amazon has Amazon Prime the 4th of April, right?
Mm-hmm. April 4th, Prime Video.
Prime Video. So go and watch this incredible, incredible film. I know I'm prejudiced, but it was a wild ride, Rudy. And we so appreciate your time being here.
Oh, I've had a blast.
Sharing
Are we done already? I have so much more to say.
Oh, we can keep on going
if you
want.
I'm kidding. That's enough Rudy for one day.
It was amazing. And thank you, Shane, for your incredible creative perspective.
Oh, you're so welcome.
And Brendan, for being my awesome co-host today.
Amazing co-host, by the way.
Yeah, he's awesome. And that concludes this episode of the Inner Circle Podcast.
Hi, I'm Shane Hurlbut, and I'm an ASC cinematographer. And my wife and I have created this incredible resource called the Filmmakers Academy. And we'd love for you to download and rate our app. If you're a filmmaker, do yourself a favor and download the Filmmakers Academy app today. It's available wherever you get your apps, most notably the App Store, Google Play, Amazon App Store, and the Roku Channel Store. The app includes everything on the platform for all access members, and from content to community and coaching opportunities, everything you need to master your craft. So download the app, and this is the most important part. Be sure to rate it. Rating us really helps us spread the word and enhance our rankings in this dedicated app store. So if you love what we're doing, this is a way to show it. Together, let's take your career as a filmmaker to the next level.